So we're going to start now. This is Adam Free Communist. So this is Jock from Communist Workers Organisation. He's going to speak about 20 minutes and then open it up. First of all,
okay, thanks for that, Mark. It kind of escaped people's notice that this is the 100th anniversary of the First World War, seeing as the media has been saturating us with all kinds of propaganda about it. In fact, it's only a fortnight since it was the anniversary of the assassination at Sarajevo of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, which led 1 month later to the Austrian invasion of Serbia, which sparked off the First World War. This, of course, has gone down with a lot of bourgeois historians as the start of the First World War, that the cause of the First World War was the assassination at Sarajevo. But the assassination was only the occasion for the war to start. In the real sense of a cause, it wasn't one at all. And in fact, we've had hundreds of capitalist commentaries about the war. The one that, right at the beginning of the year, it started off with, I don't know if everybody remembers it, with a programme by Jeremy Paxman, that extremely erudite commentator for the BBC, who told us within the first 3 minutes that Germany started the First World War, and then focused in on Hartlepool and said, for the British people, the war was a tremendously shattering event, because for the first time in history they realised they were vulnerable. What he didn't mention was that the only reason they were vulnerable is because the Royal Navy decided to move its ships to Scotland, one to the Channel, leaving the entire north of England open for attack by the Germans. But the other thing he said in the programme was, what he kept stressing was, it was democratic Britain, democratic Britain, democratic Britain. When, in fact, at the time, the majority of the working class didn't have the vote. All women didn't have the vote, and most people who didn't own some form of property did not have the vote. And so democratic Britain was supposedly what the war was about and what we were defending. And getting back to the question of the causes of the war, there's been a whole panoply of academic books, some of them written by people who I quite respect. But to be frank, they are rubbish, because all they do is they focus on what each individual actor did. You know, if von Moltke hadn't been ill that week, or the Kaiser hadn't been on holiday that week, or Grey, the British Foreign Minister, had even managed to get to Vienna, which he'd never went to anyway, because he only liked France. If all of these things had happened, there would be no First World War. And I think we can quite safely say that this is a nonsense approach. The war that broke out in 1914 had been on the cards for decades. In fact, in an earlier article, we quoted from Frederick Engels, who wrote, in 1887, no other war is possible any longer except a world war, and indeed a world war of an extensiveness and fierceness undreamt of up to now. 8 to 10 million soldiers will be at each other's throats and thereby strip all Europe bare as no swarm of locusts have ever done. That was in 1887. Engels died in 1895. One of the last things he wrote, in a Romanian newspaper, was that he hoped that in the next war there would be no national victors. And of course, that was the basis for a lot of the opposition to the war. But there was no opposition very little opposition when it started. Because the key to the understanding the First World War, and I find this quite depressing about even some anarchist organisations, is to recognise that the First World War was brought about by a specific shift in the capitalist system, a shift to imperialism, which Engels actually could only barely see in 1887, but became, as monopolies developed and as overseas policies developed, we got the scramble for Africa and all the other panoplies of imperialism, including a war race in which the British Empire was involved in an arms race with Germany over the size of their fleets. And this was the real reason that Britain went to war in 1914, not because we were defending democracy, but because we were defending the British Empire, and the British Empire was under threat from the rising German fleet. But it's, in some ways, it's quite useful that the ruling class are having this commemoration year about 1914, because it gives us the opportunity to actually say, well, yes, in 1914, the world did change forever. Yes, capitalism became a decadent social system, and it was manifestly decadent from this point onwards. And this is what we mean by the new era for capitalism. We now have a global economy in which no nation can be exempt. Engels, in the quote I gave you, he went on to say, I don't know what role China will play in the next war. In actual fact, China, of course, had been largely parcelled out between the imperialist powers by that time. But it also set in train a process, imperialism set in train a process towards a greater integration of the world economy. And this was why, in 1914, all the crises which had been building up finally came to a head. I could go through all the crises, but then the talk would be longer than the 20 minutes Mark promised you. I mean, I'll just mention some. In 1908, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, annexed Bosnia, a complete humiliation for the Russians. The Russians immediately increased the speed by which they mobilised their troops towards Germany with a new plan from 1909 onwards. In 1911, the Germans sent a gunboat to Morocco, and Lloyd George made a famous speech at the Mansion House telling them to hands off Morocco, humiliating Germany. And then in 1912-13, the Balkan Wars broke out. Wars that were so severe that in 1912, the Socialist International called a special congress at Basel, or Bâle if you're French, and said that in the event of war, they would do all they could to prevent it by the mobilisation of the working class. Not quite saying that they would actually take a revolutionary path, though. And this was one of the things that happened in 1914. In 1914, social democrats, the working class was largely in social democratic or anarcho-syndicalist organisations. And in the main, when the time came, the competing claims of workers of the world unite, you have no country, against in the hour of danger we will not leave the fatherland in the lurch, fell down on the nationalist side. The Social Democrats, in the majority, apart from the honourable exceptions of the Serbians, the Bulgarians and the Bolsheviks, all voted war credits to their respective government or supported them. I won't go into the various British ones today, but the only group, and it was a group rather than an organisation, that can claim to have had any real anti-war policy was the Socialist Labour Party. The BSP had John McLean, and John McLean didn't make any attempt to make the BSP believe in his position, so they don't quite count. But for everybody, who all workers who had been inscribed in social democracy, in Germany in particular, which was the biggest political party in history, which had the greatest majority in any elections, but of course the elections didn't count, decided not only to vote war credits for the Kaiser, but 1 month before, when the war crisis began to rumble, they told the German Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, don't worry, we will not sabotage the war effort. This was then passed on to the military high command, and they talk about the Germans giving the Austrians a blank check to attack Serbia. The Social Democrats gave the Kaiser a blank check to start the First World War in this respect. And this, we can only call it a betrayal at the time, because it was seen as a betrayal of an entire workers' movement, was not entirely unexpected. There were signs that Basel and at Stuttgart in 1907, that the social democratic conception of socialism was not internationalism as we know it. They all had a nationalist approach. It was about what you do in your country. Bringing socialism to your country was how they talked about it. And this, of course, was the Achilles heel of the whole social democratic movement, because when it came to it, country by country, they all found an excuse for supporting their own bourgeoisie. And this is a tragedy from which we've probably never recovered. Obviously, the biggest tragedy was, in fact, the German one, but the thing was repeated across Europe. And it wasn't just the Social Democrats, of course. In the Solfed pamphlet, you can read Fighting for Ourselves. It tells you quite clearly that the CGT, gave their support. They called off the class struggle and gave their support to the French war effort. And in Germany, of course, they called it the Burgfrieden, the civil peace. And so for the war, there was going to be no disruption. And it was the same with the trade unions and the Labour Party in Britain. At this point, it was the absolute nadir of the social democratic movement. Rosa Luxemburg contemplated suicide. Lenin thought, when he saw the first edition of Vorwärts after the declaration of war, that they'd voted for the war effort, that it was a forgery. It was a betrayal of enormous dimensions. And this is where I think the being a revolutionary is important, because it's at this time that revolutionaries have to stand against the current, as Lenin and Zinoviev later called their magazine. You have to stand against what's happening. And the key, although Lenin wasn't the only one, he was certainly the most coherent. And although many anarchists criticised Lenin for the role he played in the later counter-revolution, this was the moment in which, for us, he defined himself as a real revolutionary above all others. Because in calling not just for peace, not just against war, but for calling for turning the imperialist war into a civil war, and for the defeat of one's own government, we said was the duty of every international socialist. And of course, he was laughed at for it. He wasn't alone. John McLean, who had been up on holiday in the Western Islands of Scotland, where his ancestors came from, came back to Glasgow, and on Glasgow Green in August 1914, the first month of the war, he made a speech which Lenin could have written. It was as close to Lenin's conception of revolutionary defeatism as anybody else made. But of course, at the time, they were in an echo chamber listening only to themselves, because the movement, the working class as a whole, embraced this idea that, oh, well, we'll have a bit of fun, we'll go off and shoot a few rifles and we'll come home by Christmas. The reality of the Industrial War, which Engels had predicted in 1887, and many other writers in the 1900s all said the next war is not going to be like any other war. Even though horses went galloping into charging against machine guns at the beginning of the war, they were quickly soon transferred into pulling cannons and artillery for the rest of the war. Another reason the war broke out was also the class struggle. It's not the only reason, it's not the main reason, but in certain countries, for example Britain, the great unrest that had occurred before the First World War severely unnerved the bourgeoisie. If you read Lloyd George's war memoirs, there's only about six volumes of them, you'll find somewhere in the middle, I think it's volume four, that he actually said they thought it was an excellent idea to go to war to mobilise the working class to fighting for the country. There had been, of course, a wave of jingoism all the way through the 1900s, particularly in regard to the Royal Navy, but this was how he saw it. And, of course, in Russia, which had gone to war against Japan in 1904, thinking that it picked a very easy fight against what the Tsar called little brown monkeys, and it turned rather nasty for them, they had gone to war because, according to the Minister of Interior, Plev, a short victorious war would put a stop to all the strikes that Russia was facing. And from 1912 onwards, when the Lena goldfield miners struck and were massacred, 200 of them were massacred by the Tsarist police, a wave of strikes that again was engulfing Russia, which in 1914 was reaching a crescendo, and was, with the declaration of war, tailed off immediately. So the war was also part of the class struggle, and a class struggle, I would insist, that is going on today for our minds to try to make us think that somehow there was something ethical about what they were doing, when in fact this is a war about imperialist butchery. And to return to our revolutionary defeatists, of course, they had to wait for 3 years of this butchery to carry on before they finally were able to see some reward for what they were advocating. The ridicule that they'd experienced had already been partially overcome with the calling of conferences at Kiental and Zimmerwald in Switzerland, which, although the majority of the socialist parties there were just pacifist, there was a Zimmerwald left that actually came up with an anti-war manifesto not so far removed, but not as good as, the position of Lenin on turning the war into a war for socialism, a war of the working class against capitalism. But in February 1917, of course, when workers, and initially women workers, from the textile factories of Petrograd, when they took to the streets, they had two demands on their banners. One was for an end to the cuts in wages and rationings. The other was simply down with the war. And this down with the war was what now chimed with what the underground Bolshevik organization, which was carrying this message into the working class, were saying. And this was what paved the way all through the 1917 for the rise of Bolshevism, because Bolshevism was above all anti-war. I noticed, was that Chuff that wrote that book, A People's Tragedy? Orlando Figes. He wrote, if it hadn't been for the war, there would have been no revolution in Russia. Yeah. It makes it as if to say, well, you know, the war was an aberration. The war was an imperialist war, and it turned into a class war, and the class war started in Russia. And it was, in fact, the working class that demanded the end to the war. It was the working class that actually brought about the end of the war. Because the Russian Revolution of February started an agitation which ended up with the October Revolution, because the parties that took over after February refused to end the war. By refusing to end the war, they turned the Bolshevik Party from a party of a few thousand into a party of hundreds of thousands, and hundreds of thousands of activists who were prepared to fight on the anti-war agenda. And once the Bolsheviks got into power, of course, the first thing they did, or second thing possibly, was issue a decree on peace. Now, I'm not a great fan of decrees. They're just pieces of paper. But they also set markers, political markers. And this political marker was a threat to the international bourgeoisie. That here the Russian proletariat had ended the war. They knew how to end the war. Here there was a message to the workers of the world from that revolution. How would the workers respond? Well, obviously the bourgeoisie scrambled. The first thing that they did was, in January 1918, Woodrow Wilson issued his 14 points for a just and lasting peace. And this was the first attempt by the ruling class to respond to the Russian Revolution. There'd been no such attempt previously in the whole of the First World War. There was no attempt at negotiated solution, because an imperialist war is a war to the death. It's a guerre à outrance, as they say in France. It means that you win, and it's a zero-sum game. And that's what imperialist war is about. Of course, what often happens is that in the course of it, the victors also lose. I mean, the British Empire fought two wars in the 20th century and destroyed its empire, even though it finished on the winning side in both cases. But of course, the Russian Revolution had issued the declaration to workers everywhere, and the workers responded. In 1918, the British Army had 1.5 million, this is at a time of war, 1.5 million soldiers in factories, in industrial areas, to prevent civil unrest, strikes, and opposition to the war. But of course, it took another year before there was a second revolution, and this came in November the 9th, 1918, in Kiel and Wilhelmshaven, when the sailors there revolted against the order they'd been given, which was simply go and die, go and take on the British Navy now that we've lost. And they said, well, we don't see the point in this. And so they made their revolution. And then linked up with the townsfolk and set up workers' councils, copying those that had been set up in Russia. And this was the hope at this point that the world revolution could break out. It gave great heart to the revolutionaries in Russia, because up till then they had said, without a German revolution, we are doomed. And everybody had said this, and they agreed on it. But, the German revolutionaries had not created a separate organisation that was as distinct as the Bolsheviks. The Spartacus League was still part of a centrist party called the USPD in Germany. Nobody knew who they were in November 1918. As a result, their influence was not as widespread. And social democracy, which was actually an incredibly right-wing movement with lots of really out-and-out imperialists, especially in the trade union leadership of social democracy, they still had a stranglehold over the majority of the working class. And in the months that followed, what they did was they manoeuvred to turn the councils into just organisations that would approve the setting up of a new bourgeois parliamentary democracy. Against this, Karl Liebknecht impetuously and foolishly called the Spartacus Revolt in January 1919. And the Social Democrats did their work for capitalism again. Because when the war ended, the German army was not disarmed. They were allowed to march back to Germany from France with full military formation, carrying their weapons. The German army had a quarter of a million officer class men alone, and they came home with their arms. And a lot of these formed part of the Freikorps. And the Freikorps were unleashed on the workers of Berlin on the orders of General Groener, who had earlier had a telephone conversation with Ebert, the leader of the Social Democratic Party, who said, yes, come to the rescue of the government in Berlin. And the crushing of the Spartacus Revolt in January 1919, the murder of in cold blood of 400 communists, including Karl Liebknecht, Rosa Luxemburg, and later Leo Jogisch, all contributed to the weakening of the class movement in Germany and to its ultimate defeat. And that's, of course, one of the tragedies of the 20th century. And it's one of the reasons why, when we look back on that period, you cannot help think that this was a time which we have not seen since, and you sometimes wonder if you ever see again, because it was a time when there was a strong working class movement that was capable of threatening the bourgeois order. And the revolutionary wave carried on, some say carried on till the crushing of the Shanghai commune in 1926, but it was increasingly feeble echoes in each of the successive revolts after that period. But the final consideration should be about today, because it's not clear why the ruling class have gone in for the commemorations that they have gone in for. I was going to call it the common market, Josh, I'm demonstrating my age again. The European Union has given money to every government to hold these commemorations. Children are being funded to go and find ancestors who died on the battlefield or who are not recognised on war memorials. There are projects galore about this. And it seems to be that for the European Union, it wants to show that, well, the Europe we've got now is civilised, grown up, democratic. And therefore, we look back on this past and say this was what it was like in the past, and if we don't have a European Union, we'll have it again. For national governments, so I think the agenda is slightly different. I think the agenda has been like it's been for the last 30 or 40 years. I don't know if anybody else can remember, but in the 60s and 70s, if anybody had talked about anything patriotic or nationalistic, people just laughed. You know, they used to make you try and stand up for the Queen being played, or the national anthem, as they call it, after the end of the cinemas. We all used to walk out. In fact, my granddad was the last person who tried to stop people doing it. This kind of attitude was prevalent, that we all said, stuff the war, stuff the nationalism, stuff the flag. And in fact, I don't remember. The only time I remember seeing a Union Jack was when the Queen drove past the bottom of our street and my mother forced me to come down there and wave a flag when I was about six. And that was about all you saw. You never saw it. Then, of course, we had the bloody Falklands War. And the Falklands War was another of those little game changers where suddenly nationalism was okay. And instead of sending off trained hired killers called soldiers, we were now sending off heroes who all came back as heroes, whether they came back dead or alive. And we got charity after charity starting up. Red poppies, never saw them in the 1950s and 60s. Gradually saw one or two in the 70s. Now suddenly, if you don't put a poppy on your counter, it's a bit like the Nazis used to collect Winterhelfen. If you didn't pay into the Nazi collection box, the SA came round and beat you up. Well, they don't come round and beat you up, but they certainly put your business in the paper and you risk losing your livelihood. And it's very much been the tone since then. And all this I see as preparation for another nationalist kind of identification that's in some ways much more insidious and deeper than the jingoism that the music halls used to portray before the First World War. At the moment, war is not on the agenda, but, and this is the last point for all those who are getting a bit faint, the war preparations can clearly be seen. And I'm not just talking about the border skirmish in Ukraine, where the Russians are trying to actually get back something of what they've lost over the last 20 years. But I'm also talking of things like the formation of the Shanghai Cooperation Council of Iran, Russia, China. I'm also talking about what's happening in the South China Sea, where, what is it, about a third of the world's trade or half the world's trade passes through, where the Chinese are trying to steal bits of the Paracel Islands off Vietnam. They're setting up all kinds of little games in the Spratly Shoal and in Scarborough Shoal and the Spratly Islands. So that all around the world, there are increasing tensions, and these tensions are not light ones. The Americans are turning their gaze on Asia. They have previously been cutting armaments because they thought the Cold War was over. They are now beginning to go back to rearming. And I even saw an editorial in some financial journal from Wall Street, which was on Facebook, so it just went past me, and I can't remember the name of the journal. But it actually said, what we really need is a really good war, an old-fashioned war, a total war, because that would improve the economic situation. And, of course, in the last analysis, that's what they need. We've lived in the same crisis since 1973, a crisis of stagnating capitalism. To get out of it, they really need to devalue capital. But they know that devaluing capital means, in our epoch, a massive destruction via war. They've tried little wars. They've got wars that never end all around the planet in Africa. But it's not enough. They need another big war. And I think as long as this crisis exists, the danger will be posed. It won't happen today, but we might be in 1887. You know, in 20 years' time, capitalism will deliver what its system has always promised. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Right, anybody wants to make any contributions?
I think if you'd have been in the meeting before this one, I think there is.
You speak up there.
Sorry. If you'd have been in the meeting before this one, you can, maybe you'd have detected some sort of continuation. Because the meeting before this one was talking about a popular left-wing movement. And I think that what Jacques was saying illustrates the problem with the measuring the labour movement by size alone. So, and not the enormous social democratic movement, Kautsky's Second International, at the end of the day, came to nothing, because essentially they didn't really believe in Marxism. They didn't believe in revolutionary Marxism. They'd abandoned that idea. They thought that capitalism would improve forever, and the reality was that they just wanted a bigger slice of the pie, and particularly for the people in the parties and the trade union leaders. That was the reality, and I think that it illustrates the reality that there are no shortcuts, there are no easy ways, that unless the revolutionary movement is based on solid principles, then the size of it doesn't really matter.
Just make a brief point. 100 years ago, imperialism was pretty clearly centred on the established colonial powers, Britain, France, to a lesser extent, Belgium, Ireland, no, certainly Germany was up and coming. And without the pleasure of visiting Swakopmund in Namibia a few years ago, it's got a monument there for 21 German submariners who died in 1901. Didn't mention that they died exterminating an entire tribe. I think it must have been the first genocide of the 20th century. So you had different centres of imperialism arising. Since the First World War, it's been very much the American century. America as the sort of powerhouse of the great imperialist power, although we still have Britain and others as lesser satellites, as it were, of it. And I think it's true to say there are tensions emerging between Germany and America, for example. Each national centre has its own interests to promote. But it's very much still America, although it's in a certain extent of decline, still very much the dominant power.
Anybody else want to pick up on it?
I think what you're saying is interesting, Mike, because I think it actually leads into one of the problems that we're looking at the moment, trying to get this in some sort of order. The problem I want to talk about is that the left wing have developed a very bad habit over a very long time of looking at conflicts and looking at wars and deciding that there's lesser evils among the various ruling class elements, whether the national movements, who they see as somehow being progressive, or whether they see small nations as being having defensive interests that is valid to argue for, or whether somehow they see America as the great Satan and other nations as either being lesser Satans or slightly more angelic. And I think when we're trying to say at the current time we're talking about no war but class wars, that's a propaganda slogan. That is quite important, but what that actually means is that imperialism in 1914 and anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism in 1914, even then, wasn't saying let's defend small nations, because it's precisely if anyone had an argument about it, then arguably the Serbians could have said, we're a small nation, we're getting absolutely pulverised here by bigger powers. Please, proletariat, come behind our national banner. And it was actually precisely the Serbian socialists who prominently said, no, that's not what revolutionary socialism is about. It's that there's no place for defence of the national interest. I think that when you look at the sort of wars that are already taking place, and I think Ukraine and what's going on in there, and the Russian attempt, as Jock said, to try and regain the position in world imperialism that they've lost over the last couple of decades, I think you see there's a lot of the left who are thrashing around and moving towards positions where somehow defence of Ukrainian national interests or defence of the interests of the Russian minority in Ukraine, somehow there needs to be choices made, whereas the real proletarian choices to say we've got no interest in either of those. It seems to me that most of the left, and some of them quite explicitly, the Maoists who were standing next to an Orbi, were absolutely explicit that they think that the separation out of the Russian-speaking areas in Ukraine and their reunification of Holy Mother Russia is something that workers should support. Socialist Workers' Party in the USA are very much on the other side. For them, the May Day movement was an expression of progressive nationalism, and the nasty Russians are taking away Ukrainian national self-determination. I think that you see very clearly there that there's 101 other instances, certainly around the breaking of the old Yugoslavia, where the left ended up taking sides, whether it's in favour of Kosovo independence or whether it's in favour of the defence of the Milosevic regime against all the bourgeois forces. I think we have to be very careful that in this epoch, imperialism isn't about anti-imperialism, it isn't about opposing this national entity or that national entity. It's about saying that the whole world system is leading to the destruction of human civilization. That imperialism isn't something where there's good bits and bad bits to be weaned out. That the whole world system is something which has a world class where we have to oppose, and to be led into critical support for this or that ruling class faction, whether it's an existing nation or a would-be nation, that all of that is absolutely poisonous. And I think that's actually why I believe that no war but class war actually is quite a useful propaganda slogan at the current time, because it's very clear that we're not going to fall into those traps. And the way we're actually warning people against falling into those traps.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Are you talking for Canada?
No, I mean that's globally, of course, but because there is, like you said, like more, like, yeah, growing awareness of it. Do you think there's could be enough awareness possible, maybe not existing, but possible, to have a different outcome if states were to agitate towards the war?
I think at the moment they're winning. You can, you know, if you look at the way in which we here we are facing our sixth or seventh year of austerity, and you look at the resistance or lack of it, then the sense that there's a workers' movement or any kind of workers' resistance at present time is very low. I mean, obviously, last Thursday was a bit of a union procession, but what was behind it, you realise, was not a lot. I mean, if there were 1.4 million workers on strike, less than 1% of them were actually involved in picketing or demonstrating, and that is a worrying feature. It suggests that we haven't got a class movement, because I think, as I said, war, going to war is an attack on the working class. So if the war, if the working class are actually fighting hard enough, then it could prevent war. On the other hand, though, in the dialectics of history, in some places, it can actually encourage the bourgeoisie to gamble more with war in the hope to suppress a class movement. So there's no fixed answer from history as to what we can do. But at the present time, the situation from a British, in looking at the British working class, and in fact probably the whole of the European working class, is that the resistance is inadequate to create the kind of anti-imperialist movement you're talking about. I've actually just come back from Canada, and I actually said when I landed there, I've come to another planet, because it was a much more class-conscious, much more, where I was in Montreal, it was a much more class-conscious and a much more antagonistic setup, whereby it was possible to see that a movement, especially in Quebec, could arise, especially in the big towns like Toronto, in Ontario as well, where always the dichotomy between rich and poor is even greater there than it is in Europe. And I just did think that, yeah, it was more encouraging there than it is here. But at the moment, I think we're a long way from any kind of organised resistance.
I think you said something like that anti-imperialism is necessarily anti-capitalist, but I think there are examples of anti-imperialist movements that aren't anti-capitalist. And I'm thinking about, you know, off the top of my head, I've just read Paul Matic, the US wars in Indochina, Vietnam, yeah? And much of the struggle within the USA, I think you could call it anti-imperialist, but not anti-capitalist. So there's no automatic identification between the desire to thwart your nation's imperialist desires and revolutionary anti-capitalism. If you will just elaborate on what you think the role of violence in class war. What does class war actually mean?
Well, I think with the thing about anti-imperialism, for example, in Turkey, anti-imperialism is sort of state ideology. The state ideology is based upon anti-imperialism. Now, Turkey still has troops in Cyprus. Turkey regularly puts troops into northern Iraq and bombs northern Iraq on an almost weekly basis at the moment. But this is an anti-imperialist country. It's always told to us it's anti-imperialist. So, what does anti-imperialism mean? I think it was about 5 years ago now, in the last big war in Iraq, and there was some anti-imperialist demonstration organised for just after the war started. And then the war started, and they had they tacked on a bit about Iraq, and most of the left were on this demonstration, and they were shouting about US out of the Middle East. they didn't like to mention that the Turkish army was like in effect sort of bombing people. And this is anti-imperialism, I think. And today, I don't think there's anything anti-imperialist about anti-imperialism. It's supporting one side of the imperialists. And you know, you take this side, you take that side. But I think anti-imperialism is a very bankrupt idea today, even.
The problem is not so much anti-imperialism, it's understanding of imperialism. And what is imperialism? When the left has a broad group of people that most of us here don't consider ourselves to be part of, sees the US as being imperialist, and you know, Britain as being imperialist, and Israel as being imperialist, but other countries as not being imperialist, then I think you're quite right that anti-imperialism maybe means supporting one group of countries, or one country, or one group of people in a country that isn't whoever is supported by Britain, America, or Israel. So currently in Ukraine, the pro-Russian groups are saying, yeah, well, the junta in Kiev is a fascist occupation by America and the EU, who put their neoliberal friends in power in Kiev, and therefore all good anti-imperialists will support Putin in his plan to liberate the Russian speakers in the South and East. But very few of them ever mention the destruction of Grozny and the fact that the inhabitants of the inhabitants of Chechnya who wanted to break away from the Russian Federation were not afforded the same rights of national state and self-determination as the Russian speaking minority in Ukraine is now being afforded by the government. So Russia has this point is against the foreign policy of the US is seen as being somehow anti-imperialist, though it's obviously an imperialist government, because imperialism isn't set of policies that a country adopts or doesn't adopt. It's a dynamic of capitalism in the current period, yeah, whereby all capitalist countries have to compete with each other economically, militarily, strategically. So all countries are therefore imperialist. Possible exception of Costa Rica, which doesn't have an arm, but I'm not going to go into the case of Costa Rica. So if imperialism is seen as only a policy adopted by certain countries, primarily the US, then anti-imperialism can mean anything, as long as it means being opposed to American foreign policy. And I think this is the big problem with anti-imperialism as a concept. That there's no understanding of imperialism as a concept.
I think just to say a couple of points about Ukraine. I think it is true that the EU and America with a hidden hand, and not a hidden hand behind the mayhem of France. And we did so in conscious collaboration with outright fascist forces, no doubt about that. And one of the outcomes of the project would be dismantling of the industries in the Middle East. Having said that, a separatist project didn't offer any alternative, nor does the machinations of Putin, who looks to be quite willing to see a separatist movement massacred, about to happen. The working class in the area does appear to give a lot of support to the separatist movement. I've seen video clips of marches of miners on strike, 1,000, 2,000, marching behind a band or a loudspeaker playing old Red Army songs and a Rise Great Nation type of fascist forces. that's the situation they're in. They're going to get hammered. There's no way we can say that what they are offering is an alternative to the Kiev EU-American project. But the ultimate aim of that project is not just to impose its will on Eastern Ukraine, but to attack Russia and put an eye on that massive area, one-sixth of the world's landmass, which has got huge mineral resources. And I think that's it. I'm not suggesting for a moment that the government in Moscow or any of the oligarchs they represent offer an alternative for that. And the only alternative is cash flow. And somehow we've got to get that message across.
From what you were both saying, actually, I think that anti-imperialism, we reject if it's not part of anti-capitalism, and I think we can say the same about fascism. We don't support anti-fascism per se. So it's, these are slogans to mobilise the working class to defend the capitalist states. And I think that in the slogan "No War But Class War," it is a slogan against anti-fascist war, which is not at the same time revolutionary communism.
Okay, one more bite.
5 minutes, so yeah, okay.
2000, whatever it was, when the Iraq War started, I remember we had a meeting. To discuss no war but class war in that context. We had a slightly larger meeting than this, and everybody was, yeah, no war but class war. But nobody wanted to do anything about it. It seemed as though people were content to make the record, and I'm just wondering whether we can extend the net a bit wider, engage other organisations in discussion around this, and not merely have it as an occasional propaganda exercise, but make it something which has a bit of flesh on the bones and gets some attention in the working class.
Yeah, I'll just come in, and then I'm going to just let Job summarise. I kind of agree. I just wanted to also plug my paper because it's a special edition, and it's actually got some of the stuff that Job was talking about in his talk about some of the people who did resist the First World War. I'll just let Jock summarise.
Well, we've only got 3 minutes and 56 seconds, so I'll just say thank you for the contributions you had. I liked the way that the discussion on imperialism, or anti-imperialism and imperialism, each person built on what everybody else said, and we actually got a definition at the end that we live in a world that is anti. The whole capitalist setup is imperialist today. There are no state can escape that. There's no good progressive body we can support, and no body that we'd be against. We're against all the sides in the Ukraine, for example, because there is nothing worth supporting. What we stand for is the independence of the working class, and that has to remain the basis for any revolution defeatist, no war but class war policy. Thank you all for coming.